Welcome to the RhinoCast. My name is Eric Gladstone, and we are pleased to have in studio today a very special guest, Mr. Otis Williams of the legendary Temptations. Welcome, Otis.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome as well.
It's very, very nice to have you here. Now, for those who don't fully grasp the legacy of the Temptations, you are going on your 45th year together.
Absolutely. Still having fun.
And you have a new album out, which is very exciting, and we'll talk about in a minute. But for some of the younger fans, I wanted to just briefly touch on a few historical moments. The group was formed in 1961.
Correct.
And you and the late Melvin Franklin were The Distance?
Yes, we were. Yeah, we were Otis Williams in The Distance, and we were recording for a little small company called Northern Records. And we had a fairly nice original hit with that small company, which drew Berry Gordy's attention to us because we were so popular in the Detroit area that that's when he was starting out with his own label, Motown Records.
So you you guys were in The Distance. How did you hook up with Eddie, who had, I think, had come up from Birmingham with a group called The Primes?
Oh, Eddie Kendricks?
Yeah.
Well, you see, back during, like, 59, Eddie Kendricks, Paul Williams, and a guy by the name of Kel Osborne, they had a trio called The Primes. And my group, speaking of The Distance, The Primes and The Primettes, which later became known as the Supremes, we were being managed by a gentleman named Milton Jenkins. And we all used to rehearse at this here complex that he would have for us all to rehearse, you know, at the same time. So that's how we met Paul, Eddie, and Kel. And as fate would have it, for whatever reason, Eddie and Paul went back to Birmingham, so I guess The Primes broke up. And then Eddie came back to Detroit. And at this time, we were in need of a first tenor, because the guys, a couple of guys that we had, were no longer with the group. And Barry had seen my group, The Distance, at, say, back in those days, we used to have to do what they call record hops. Mm-hmm. And whenever your record was released, you would have to go around to the disc jockeys, record hops, like from Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and promote your records. And so Barry saw my group before we lost a couple of members at St. Stephen's Community Center. Mm-hmm. And he said he was he liked my group, and for us to come see him, he was starting Motown. And at that time, when we lost two of the guys, Eddie Kendricks called me, and he said, "Hey, man, what you doing?" I said, "Who is this?" He said, "Eddie, I'm back in town." I said, "Well, man, this must be a godsend, because I'm in need of a tenor." Mm-hmm. He said, "Oh, great." No, he said, "Well, I'll come over." He said, "Well, can Paul join the group?" I said, "Man, as good as Paul Williams can sing, yeah, you definitely need to bring him." So they came to where I was living at the time, and that's when, now, the original Temps, the very original Temps, were Paul Williams, Eddie Kendricks, a guy by the name of Elbridge Bryant, right, Melvin Franklin, and myself. And our first song that we started rehearsing to was 100 Pounds of Clay by Gene McDaniels. That's how the original Temp started. And then we went to Mr. Gordy. I took him up on his on his advice, you know, about him starting the company, and he gave me a card, and he said, "Hey, should you ever leave where you are, come see me. And I'm starting my own label." And I called him, and Barry said, "Oh, great, yes." Called Mickey Stevens, who was the A&R director for Motown at the time,
right,
and, you know, "Get with him, and let's see what kind of songs you guys have, and we'll take it from there." And at that time, when we left the little small label that we were with, Johnny Mae Matthews, she kept her name, The Distance. So we said, "Well, hey, keep the name. We're young enough. We'll find and start off with another name." So we were The Elgins for a minute. And then we found out there was another group called Elgins. And so one
Darling Baby.
Huh?
The guys who did Darling Baby.
Darling Baby, true,
yeah,
right. And so one day we were standing out front of Motown, and the guy that worked in Motown, his name was Bill Mitchell. So as we were kicking out names, you know, all kind of names was, you know, being thrown out. And so he said, "Well, what about Temptations?" And I said, "Hey, I like that." And I said, "That's got a ring to it." And so I asked the guys, "What did they think?" And Paul, and we'll forget what Paul said, he said, "Hey, man, the name is whatever we make it, so it's fine with me." Mm-hmm. So Bill said, he hollered up to Motown's legal department said, put on the contracts, the Temptations. And that's how it all started in 1961.
Wow. Now, that's interesting because I thought, maybe I heard this wrong or maybe it's just a coincidence, I thought I'd heard that you went to high school with Smokey.
No, Melvin probably did. I went to Northwestern. I think Smokey went to Northern, which was on the east side of Detroit.
Okay.
And Northwestern is on the west side of Detroit.
Okay.
Melvin went to Northwestern for a brief period of time, and then he ended up graduating from Northern High. So that was Melvin.
Hmm. Now, so you, Smokey became your original producer and songwriter basically just through the Motown process?
Well, at that time, Barry was very experimental with a lot of his acts. You know, it was like whomever would come up with the right songs, you know. Mm-hmm. So Smokey, Clarence Paul, Norman Whitfield, a little later on, Barry himself, you know, would come along, and everybody would do, you know, songs, you know, and they would have this meeting at the end of the day,
right.
At the end of the week, you know, and they would listen and see which would be, good enough to release. But at that time, it was quite a bit of different producers that were producing on this. And then when Smokey came up with the hit The Way You Do the Things You Do, which was 1964,
right.
That's when he really became our producer on a more fluent, basis. And so we had about three or four-year run with Smokey. And then Norman Whitfield, because Norman even did some songs with us, you know, but before he really latched on to us with Ain't Too Proud to Beg.
Yeah.
And the very interesting thing about how we left switched from Smokey to Norman, Norman Whitfield had recorded Ain't Too Proud to Beg.
Mm-hmm.
Smokey had recorded Get Ready.
Yeah.
So Barry was in a quandary because Smokey had a string of hits on us,
right.
But Barry was in love with Ain't Too Proud to Beg.
So they were both in the can at the same time?
We had both recorded them at the same time.
Yeah, ready to go.
And so Norman, being the kind of aggressive person that he is,
right?
He was staying on Barry's hips. This is a hit. This is a hit. You know, and so Barry, I never will forget. He said, "Well, here's what I'll do." He said, "Smokey, since I that you've had such a string of hits on attempts, we'll go with you on Get Ready, but it will have to break into the top 10. If it do not make it to that top 10, Norman Whitfield will start producing. He will get the next release." And Get Ready did, I think, got like to number 22 chart-wise. And so that's how Ain't Too Proud to Beg, came into play. And from that point on, Norman had us for about 8 or 9 years of hit after hit after hit after hit.
That's, we're going to get to Norman in a second, but that's actually, Get Ready is such a great song. I'm actually surprised it didn't do better.
Yeah,
but I guess maybe that was fate or something.
Yeah, I guess, because as soon as they released Ain't Too Proud to Beg, they went through the roof.
Yeah.
And I never will forget when we were recording, when Norman played the track for me, I said, "Oh, man, the track alone, even before we put the voices on, was dynamite."
Mm-hmm.
So when we put the voices on, I never will forget David was in this. See, Motown at that time had a thing where the producers would cut most of the songs a step higher because they didn't want us to sing with too much being relaxed and not letting the audience feel the urgency, the emotion. So they would always cut stuff a little high. So Ain't Too Proud to Beg was recorded a little at David's break point in his voice.
Right.
But he pulled it off, and he was sweating, and we would take it verse by verse. And he was singing, and his glasses all cocked to the side. Norman and I said, come on, man, you can do it. We're almost there. And so when he finally finished it and came out of the control room, out of the studio into the control room, we applauded him. But he said, "Man, we got to lower that. I cannot sing it in that key every night." So we brought it down a little bit, but when you listen to even Holland Doja Holland, I listen at Reach Out, and it's got Levi right at the peak of his voice. So they had that kind of
they can get that grit,
that emotion. Yeah. They want us to feel it, because they say, if you can get it in the key that's comfortable, it won't come across as dynamic as we would like.
Interesting. Now I wanted to ask you just to step back on the Ain't Too Proud to Beg story, because when we talked to Eddie Holland a few weeks ago, he was telling us about this, too. Were you guys aware that Norman was so aggressively trying to get kind of control of you guys?
Well, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. See, Norman, and myself, we go a long way back.
Yeah.
Back to, like, to 59, 60, when we were at Northern Records, Jeremy Matthews' label.
Okay.
He was with a guy, a group called Popcorn and the Mohawks.
With Richard Wiley.
There you go. That's right.
I'm a big Richard Wiley
fan. All right. And Norman was the tambourine player.
Oh, okay.
So we knew Norman from even before we all came to Motown, and he always had that kind of aggressiveness, and he was such a pool shark in Detroit. They call him the White Fox. You know, oh yeah, he made his hustle could shoot some pool. The brother could shoot some pool, but he's always been a very aggressive person, even back before we came to Motown. So we knew that he was always. And I mean, Barry would get out of the car and he would walk up to the drive. I mean the walkway to his office, Norma would jump right dead on Barry. Right there. A man couldn't even get to his office. Barry, I promise you, man. And he wouldn't take no finance. I mean, at that time, Barry just said, all right, man, go ahead on, just to get him off of him. So, and I guess it paid off for him because Norman had a string of hits on us and a few other artists.
Yeah. Now, the competition between producers at Motown has definitely been talked about a bit. Aggressively, but I'm curious if there was a flip side to that. If the groups were ever competitive to work with certain producers, the hot producer of the moment. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, I know. Well, Barry had a systematic kind of thing. If somebody was making hits like Holland, Dozier Holland had hits on the Supremes and the Four Tops, he's not going to mess with them trying to bring. Them to us to them.
Okay.
And like Norma, either one, Smokey had hits on us. He said, now we stay with the ones that's, coming up with the hits. So it was a very systematic kind of thing,
Okay.
Now, we did do some songs with Holland, Dozier Holland that made some of the albums. But as far as the showing off big hits, they went to the ones that the Supremes and the Four Tops primarily, and vice versa with Norman, Whitfield, or Smokey, whoever had the hits on us.
So even though another producer might say, we've got a song for you, they weren't really trying to, they knew that they, if you belonged to a certain producer, so to speak.
Well, what they would also do, they would probably say, okay, go and record it. And every Friday, they would have what they call quality control meeting. And they would listen at it, that everything that was recorded during that week. Now, if that producer came up with something that was really strong, then they would probably green light him, so it just depends. It would have to be super strong, for them to, get that kind of release in comparison to Norman Whitfield or Smokey Robinson.
But you guys were not trying to, like you guys didn't feel in competition with Four Tops or, Spinners or someone like that, for example.
Well, it was a friendly kind of competitive kind of thing. I mean, the temps, we always loved to, we wanted to do some of Holland, Dozier Holland, stuff, because those guys were so creative, far as the melodies, the chord structure, and the way it just flowed, they had downstairs in one of the buildings where they had rehearsal hall rooms, and you could hear Holland Dozier in one room, you could hear Ashford and Simpson in another room, you could hear Ivy Joe in one room, or Smokey, and so it was just an amazing place to be, and we always wanted to do something from Holland Dozier Holland, but now if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Right. What are your personal favorites from the Temps catalog that you kind of never get tired of hearing? I know you're hearing them a lot.
Have come to realize, a long time ago, not just now, that I am truly a big Temptation fan, because sometimes, Motown released years ago Empress of Soul, which is, I think, a 5 or 6 disc hit of ours. And so I said, I'm going to sit and listen, and every tune that I listened to, and it just brought back wonderful, fond memories and things. And, I mean, you get me to rattle enough tunes that I love of the Temps, we'd be here for a while. Because, we have been amazingly, blessed to have had so many great records. Because when we started out in 1961, we had no inclination that 45 years later, we still be at it, and all of the long, wonderful, rich history of records that we made that I listened at, and I said, man, I can see why this is not trying to sound egotistical, a well-loved group, because we've had some phenomenal while we're rehearsing now, we sit and say we have a blessed curse, because we're stuck with trying to put so many great things in there. In most cases, the maximum time they want us to do is 75 to, you know, 85, maybe 90 minutes. Vegas only want us to do 45 minutes.
Right.
So we always have a tendency to feel that we kind of cheating our fans because, well, how come you guys don't do this? Right. Well, how come you guys? It's only so much we can do because we have had so many hits that we can't get them all, you know, in. Because I was being interviewed the other day, and one guy asked, and a lady asked, well, do y'all still do Treat Her Like a Lady? Yes, we still do Treat Her Like a Lady. Mm-hmm. Oh, great, because we love that song. And the ladies, when we play it, they call and they talk about, well, is there still some guys that treat me ladies like that? You know, so, you know, I said, we still do it. So, I mean, that song was out in 1985, 86.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, so we just kind of caught into having to do the best that we can with what we have.
Yeah. Now, you've had, I mean, going almost all the way back, there have been many personnel changes in the Temptations over the years. And I wonder, you've kind of been the bedrock of the whole thing from the very beginning. How have you maintained the consistency in the group?
Well, it's definitely
has it been challenging?
Oh, yes, always challenging. It's a work in progress. And, you know, I tell you, like I tell people, when we started off, it wasn't like I raised my hand and said, well, okay, I'm going to be the group leader.
Mm-hmm.
How I got caught up in this position, Jenny Mae, when she would call for rehearsals, I would walk to rehearsal. And we would all be there. And a lot of times I would be there a half hour to 15 minutes earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, Otis, you know what? I said, what, Johnny? You're never late. I didn't think nothing of it. I just said, mm-hmm. well, hey, I just, even back then, I was like 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
She said, that's a good quality to have, whether you know it or not. She said, you be the group leader. And little did I know what that would encompass later on down the line. And when we do change, which I hate to change because it just slows down everything, but one of the things that I look for more so is the heart and spirit. And when I tell it to people, they say, what, really? They think I would think of talent first.
Mm-hmm.
But what I have learned through my changes of going with different guys, you can have all the talent in the world. If you're not right here in your heart and upstairs, mm-hmm. you'll negate that talent every time.
Mm-hmm.
So talent to me is secondary. I want to know, are you of the mind? See, what we do, it's a business.
Mm-hmm.
It's a small microcosm of a Ford or General Motors or Apple, you know,
right.
but it's nevertheless, the principle is still the same.
Right.
If you get a guy that is just based on talent, but when it's time to be on time, they can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Or rehearsal things that make us evolve to keep continuing on,
mm-hmm.
then I'm not interested in the talent because you have to have the basic thing of wanting to take care of business. Oftentimes, it's more business than show. See, even though you heard the term show business,
right.
a lot of time you need to turn that business around first, then show second, because
right.
it is business.
Yeah.
And that's the way we have to look at it. And when people are putting out their hard-earned money, they don't come to see the Temptation half-ass on stage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we have created a legacy that we have to live up to that started from way back then. So I always try and find somebody, if we have to change, of good spirit and good heart, and then the talent is second. And luckily, I've been able to find on a greater percentage guys that would carry the identifiable sound that the Temps have been known for throughout the years. You know, like GC's got that grit sound, you know, like when we started out with, you know, when David came along,
yeah.
Melvin with the bass sound. Well, we got a good bass singer with Joe Herndon, Tyson doing the tenor thing that Eddie Kendricks created,
right.
and then Terry and myself holding down the rich harmonies and Terry doing his bit. So we've been able to always keep guys in there that if, when you hear a record of ours, they say, oh, we know who that is. That's Temps, because it's that kind of right. identifiable sound. So we've been very lucky.
Mm-hmm. So many of the Temps over the years have gone solo. You know, David, Eddie,
right.
Paul,
Dennis,
gave it a shot,
Dennis, Ollie.
How come you never went solo?
Well, you know, I know I'm not a soloist guy. You know, my voice, like I can say, people have asked that, and when they hear me sing, they say, man, you got a very, Tom Bell, mm-hmm. when he heard me sing, he said, oh, I should have recorded you. I said, oh, really? He said, oh, now I've heard your voice. He said, you got another kind of voice. But he only had that one shot with us. And so I've always been, I guess, like Maurice King said, he said, Otis, you are the glue. You're the glue, and I know my role. I know my strong points. I know my weak points. And so I stay with my strength. And, you know, so I know that's my role. And my ego don't run to the point of I got to get up and do it. I mean, long as we out there as a unit and doing real well and entertaining and bringing a certain kind of relaxation and helping people forget whatever woes that the world is going through, that's where I get my satisfaction from more so than stepping out front. Because when we started out singing, I was the lead singer. But, you know, over the years, you know, when you work... you know, your voice change and what have you. So I'm very comfortable with the role that I play.
Okay. Now, I did want to ask you, going back to what we were talking about, I want to ask you about kind of the difference between Smokey Robinson and Norman Whitfield as producer-songwriters for you guys.
Well, the difference between Smokey Robinson and Norman Whitfield, Norman's got that edge.
Yeah.
Norman is more challenging, you know. He's willing to go on to uncharted waters. Smokey is very, he comes to, when he would come to us, he would always come with a nice package of great songs, like the My Girls, The Way You Do the Things, Since I Lost, and those songs. And he would leave room for us to do our Temptation thing, but Smokey was very tailor-made. He always came to us with, hey, Oak, this is what I want you guys to do. And he'd sit down at the piano and give us the basics, and then we'd take it from there. You knew something?
Yeah, I was just going to... I was pulling out the Getting Ready album, one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah.
Love this cover, too, by the way.
Yeah, it was taken at the Fisher Theater in Detroit, Michigan.
Oh, okay.
But Norman was, like I say, in comparison to Smokey, was edgier.
Right.
Gritty.
Musically and as a person,
yeah.
Sounds like.
Yeah, his music fit his personality. And for us to go on the psychedelic run, how that came about, because, see, we had, you know, They Ain't Too Proud to Begs and Please Return Your Love and Losing You. But what made Norman and us go for the psychedelic soul was Kenny Gamble is a friend of mine, of Gamble and Huff.
From Philly.
Yes. We were in New York performing, and Kenny just so happened to be at the same hotel, the Warwick Hotel in New York. And every time I walk by there, I got some interesting memories about the Warwick Hotel.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But we were talking, and we heard, that was the first time we heard Sly and the Family Stone.
Okay.
With Dance to the Music. So it's him and I were talking.
This is about 67 then.
Yeah,
right.
About that time. And then we heard just Dance to the Music. And then when it broke down, boom, 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 I said, oh, that's pretty different there. I said, I like that. And Kenny said, yeah. Very interesting sound. So we flew back to Detroit, and one day Norman Whitfield and my then wife and myself, we were standing out front of a nightclub in Detroit. And I asked Norman, I said, have you heard this group called Sly and the Family Stone? He said, no, I haven't heard it. I said, well, check them out. I said, they have something very interesting that maybe we should try and do to just kind of be a little bit different. Now, at that time, we were going through the change of David Ruffin leaving into Dennis Edwards.
Okay.
And that was 68.
Right.
Because Dennis came into the group April of 1968.
Okay.
Went out of town, came back in. Norman Whitfield had recorded Cloud Nine.
So he picked it up that quick.
That quick. Evidently, he heard it. Because when I first told him about it, he was, you know, Norman being, man, that boop, bop, boop, I ain't thinking about nothing. So when he recorded it.
You guys were doing things like I Wish It Would Rain and things like that.
Our last big hit with Norman was Please Return Your Love.
Right.
And so I said, he said, oh, yeah, right, shut up. Come on, let's cut the stuff. And we went in and we recorded Cloud Nine. And it was such a departure from, Since I Lost and the Please Returns and Losing You, that when Motown released it for about a week and a half or two, very spooky. You know, normally when the Temptation record would come out, we'd get that kind of response.
Right.
And we said, okay, did we make a wrong turn here? But all of a sudden, it caught on, and it went through the roof, and we were the first act at Motown to win a Grammy record.
Wow.
Trophy. And Sold over a million, and it did very well. And so, you know, history was made, and we had we couldn't get Norman off the psychedelic soul after that, because we had a big verbal confrontation in the studio. See, Papa Was a Rolling Stone almost didn't get made.
Wow.
Because by us traveling, our fans said, yeah, but y'all, and I tell you the thing that really made us say it's time for us to change. Mm-hmm. When we did Masterpiece,
right,
we were over in England, and they gave a review, and the article said, the Norman Whitfield Singers. So we were beginning to lose our identity. That's all. Oh, no, it's time to,
It's interesting because I'm looking at the back cover here, and Norman's picture is bigger than yours.
That's true. And that's when we said, we were, at that point of saying, we need to get back to the Just My Imagination. And he said, Timps, I promise you, this is a hit. You know, so we were going back and forth in the control room for a minute. So being the artist that we are, we went into the studio, down into the studio, and we recorded it.
Was this still at Studio A?
This was a studio over on further west side of on Davison.
Okay.
Yeah. Went in and recorded it, and we left town. We had to go to Hawaii. And we performed in Hawaii. And back during those days, they had what they called disc jockey conventions.
Right. So like Jack the Rapper.
All the major companies would come to whatever city it was being held in. Mm-hmm. And the Warner Brothers, the Sonys, the Motown, all the big heavyweight companies, even the Stax, the up and coming label. Every suite that I would go into visiting, because we had friends at all those labels that we artists that we'd work with from time to time, they were playing Poppin' with a Rolling Stone.
Okay.
I said, oh, that's interesting. You go into Sony, and they playing Poppin' with a Rolling Stone. You go over to Warner Brothers, they playing Poppin' with a Rolling Stone. Okay, Norman had it, we won 2 Grammys on that. So, we almost, it almost didn't get made. But like I said, it's being artists. We did do it, but very interesting tidbit behind Papa Was a Rolling Stone.
Now, let me step back a second. Let's step back a second to Cloud Nine and Psychedelic Shack. Mm. So when you recorded that, you obviously were definitely for going in this direction.
Mm-hmm.
Was everyone in the group on board with that? Was Barry on board with that? What was the feeling around that at the time?
The Timps, we did,
because this was a radical move for you guys, really.
Well, Eddie and myself have always been that kind of way as far as wanting to try different things to stay a cut above all other groups. Mm-hmm. Barry had the attitude, hey, they have such a string of hits, I'm leaving them alone. Whatever Norman and the Timps want to do, I leave them alone.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because at that time, they were still having the quality control meeting, but whenever it came to Timps and Norman Whitfield behind having They Ain't Too Proud to Beg, The Lose and Use, and Beauty's Only Skin Deep, and all those hits, Barry's attitude, I'm not bothering them, because every time they come up with something, even though it'd be different from what I would imagine for them to come out with, it's a hit. So he didn't bother us.
Wow. That's amazing. Now, the interesting thing, not only musically was it a change with Norman Whitfield, but with Barrett Strong's lyrics, you guys started getting into these real message songs.
Yes.
Now, I'm curious if that was just kind of a spirit of the times thing. It was after Martin Luther King and all the stuff going on. There's a lot of political stuff in the air, obviously, Vietnam.
Sure.
Protests.
Yes.
And so forth. Was that a feeling that you guys wanted to get into, or was there any concern about, going that far out,
away from
the love songs and things like
that?
Oh,
no, it was definitely a sign of the times, and we felt as though love is always needed. We wanted to sing about what we were going through as a world, because, like I said, it's been noted that the 60s were the most tumultuous decade in the last 100 years, because here we are 40-some, almost 50 years later, and we're living off of certain ideologies that were spawned from the 60s.
Right.
We wanted to capture, because you're right, Vietnam was at its peak. Mm-hmm. Dr. King was making his move. A women liberation, you know, you start doing mm-hmm. women talking about, hey, if you're getting a man getting paid, the woman should get paid the same thing. Mm-hmm. The old adage, anything you can do, I can do better. You know, all that was right. jumping off at the time. And so we were singing, you know, a sign of the times, and it's something that we wanted to do. Mm-hmm. You know, because we just didn't want to be pigeonholed as just a one-dimensional kind of group. We always okay. like for our fans to say, wow, boy, the temps are always challenging. I always want to try something new. Because back during 1966, we did something that was truly unheard of when we came up with Temps in a Mellow Mood. You know, mm-hmm. that was unheard of for an R&B group to start messing around with great standards.
Right.
You know, so that's, we always, and we pride ourselves like that today, of always trying to do things in a way it would leave our fans of saying, don't surprise me, the Temps will try most anything, you know.
Right.
That's within keeping, and that's within character of the Temps. We do not venture out of something that would make us be ridiculous sounding or ridiculous looking.
Well, even one of the things I always thought was interesting about you guys was even in the height of the Norman Whitfield era, you guys were still maintaining the other side, the more mature side,
sure.
the more elegant side, and this as the Talk of the Town live record's a really good example of that. I mean, you do I'm Gonna Make You Love Me, uh-huh. then you do The Impossible Dream,
yes.
Runaway Child, Don't Let the Joneses, Love Theme from Romeo and Juliet. This, yeah. this is the set list I'm going down here. Uh-huh. I Can't Get Next to You, This Guy's in Love with You, the
right.
Burt Bacharach song.
Right.
And then, you know, I've Got to Be Me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I'm Losing You, Cloud Nine. You know, it's so, it's interesting. You always, so if you correct me if I'm wrong, you always sort of felt it important to maintain both sides and serve
sure.
a wide audience.
Wide demographics was very
wide. WIDE.
Yes. it was very wide back then as it is now.
Mm-hmm.
See, the wonderful thing about being at Motown.
Mm-hmm.
We went to school about being in show business.
Right.
It is our vocation rather than our avocation.
Mm-hmm.
We would have to, they had a wonderful department called Artist Development.
Right.
And Charlie Atkins, the late great Charlie Atkins,
right.
and late great Maurice King, Johnny Allen, Harvey Fuqua,
right.
Barry, our manager even of today, Shelley Berger.
Uh-huh.
They would instill in us, if you guys are going to be in show business for the long haul. Don't be in it just for the thing of having a few hit records and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so by doing that, they said you guys need to do things that other groups probably wouldn't think about doing, you know, like The Impossible Dream, Hello Young Lovers.
Mm-hmm.
So they were gearing us to go into the Copacabanas, to work Las Vegas, you know, the real high-profile mm-hmm. Rooms. And so we had a different kind of mindset rather than the same old R&B kind of thing that we started
right.
out with. So that's why, I guess, part and parcel, we are still around today because, well, when we leave here, GC and myself have to meet up with the rest of the guys because we're mm-hmm. working with Lon Fontaine, who was mm-hmm. one of the guys back during the day. That was also very instrumental in creating a certain kind of image. Well, we are staging a new show with Lon,
mm-hmm.
you know, and one part of the show has got one song in there that's kind of like a High Lows for Freshmen Take Six kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
just to, oh, Temps is doing something different, you know, for that, you know, surprise element kind of thing. So we've always prided ourselves on trying to stay very, you know, on a broad basis rather than mm-hmm. just pigeonhole us in one set idiom.
To me, it was just, I mean, it's just... not to stay on this for too long, but it's really interesting when you think about it that at times like back in the early 70s, people were really kind of polarized, you know. I mean, there was the establishment and there were, you know, there was the underground. And you guys were making some definitely very radical records
mm-hmm.
in some respects.
Right.
Very, you know...
Controversial.
Controversial, very, you know... sort of oriented towards a, you know, a rock, a younger audience. The fact that you could make those records and yet still you could go into the Copacabanas and the cabarets
sure.
and do that too, did anyone ever have a problem with that? I mean...
No, it was a delicate balance that had to be had, and we mm-hmm. we kind of walked the tightrope without falling off of it mm-hmm. really well. a lot of times when we would play the Copacabanas, the Vegases, we would do our hits, you know, but certain songs that were kind of extreme, we wouldn't do that because, you know.
Give me an example.
Oh, well, like the one you wanted to ask me about.
Run, Charlie, Run.
We said, no, we won't do that here. no, we won't do that here. So we would go with the Impossible Dreams, mm-hmm. or even at that time, we would open up our show with Hello, Young Lovers. Mm-hmm. And then we'd come out of that into what the Temps are really noted for.
Right.
You know, so it was a balance that had to be had. But we had great minds around us, you know, Maurice King, Charlie Atkins, you know, and Barry would come out there with his crew and they would critique us. Temps, you need to, don't do that. You know, so they would critique us. And so we had some great mindset people behind us that were guiding us of how to do, what not to do, when to do it, if to do it at all. You know, so we walked the tightrope pretty well. So we're very blessed to have had some very strong, influential people that helped the Temps evolve.
And then were you playing, like, college shows at the same time?
Sure was.
And then you would...
Yeah.
Then you're not doing the Impossible Dream at that show.
But you know what? Sometimes we would even do it when we left the Copa, after we broke all existing records at the Copacabana, mm-hmm. we went to back to our theater shows, you know, like
mm-hmm. and we Howard Theater, that kind of stuff.
Would open up with Hello, Young Lovers.
No kidding.
Or we would do The Impossible Dream.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and what's so killing, they really appreciated it because mm-hmm. it was like, oh, okay, Temps is doing... I like that. So, yeah, it showed a different kind of versatility. That is so. Now, right. we would do those kind of songs even in our regular R&B places that we were noted to play.
So you're saying in terms of working with Barrett Strong and the message songs, that was a kind of a collective idea that you guys wanted to sing about this stuff? I mean, would Barrett kind of sort of say, okay, this is the song, or would Norman say, we want to do this song? How would it work?
Oftentimes we would be on the road, and mm-hmm. Norman and Barry would already have laid the track. So when we would come in off the road mm-hmm. and it was time for us to record, Norman would present the song to us, you know. So, and
do you remember any time they presented a song where you guys just kind of had to, like, take a minute?
Other than Papa Was a Rolling Stone, and that wasn't because of the lyrics. It was just we got tired of being in that psychedelic soul. But no, most cases, whenever Norman and Barry would bring a song to us, we would record it. And,
Stop the War Now, for example.
Yeah.
I actually was on Edwin Starr, I think.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Well, that was in response to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
you know, because... you know, it was very, very crucial times, you know, back then. And we were on a world tour in 75, you know, and I think the war in Vietnam ended, what, G, in 74?
Mm-hmm.
We were on a world
tour. Depends on who you ask.
Well, he's a Vietnam vet.
Oh, are you?
Yeah, okay. He was over there. And I'm happy God brought him back, you know, all in one piece, you know, because, like I said, we were on a world tour and we were in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And we ran across some guys that were over in Nam, and they recognized who we were.
Right.
But when they started running down what our music meant to them,
mm-hmm.
during the times of fighting, and when they started running it down, the brothers started crying.
Wow.
Tears well up, and they started crying. And it was so touching the way they was running it down, I started crying because he said, you guys just don't know what your music did for us. And I would hear GC say the same thing about, whenever there was a lull in the fighting and they would go back, I guess they had little bases that they would go back to after the end of the day.
Yeah.
They said first thing they would do is put on the Motown record or put on the Temps, put on the Smoker.
Right.
Say, you guys' music. And the thing of coming back to the States was we had to get back to the world, and that's what they referred to the States as, getting back to the world.
Uh-huh.
And when they ran it down to us, and man, it was so touching that I said, wow, I didn't know the impact of what our music had during those times over in Vietnam until you hear somebody sit and run it down to you like they did. And I'm sure when you talk with GC, he can probably enlighten you even more so than I, because mm-hmm. he was over there fighting during that time.
What do you remember about the first time you heard Ball of Confusion?
Oh, I thought that was funkier than an unwashed armpit. When I heard that track alone,
mm-hmm.
oh, I said, oh, man, because at that time Motown was down on Woodward Avenue right at the Edsel Freeway.
Okay.
And so we would come down there instead of going to Studio A on West Grand Boulevard.
Right.
Motown had moved downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we first heard the track, because Norman was there again, very geek. You know, man, I got the Jim Johnson. This track is, you know, he was just carrying on. And I listened to that and went, and all those different sound effects. Mm-hmm. I said, oh, man, this is good and fucking. And then he ran down the lyrics. And the lyrics, when you listen at that, depict the times that we were living.
Right.
You know, so I loved it. And I still love it today because, like I said, it's one of our funky tracks there.
Yeah.
Then especially when it went to that Matilda. Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
Boom, 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 boom. I said, oh, yeah, I love that because it reminded me of Matilda, You Take My Money and Run Venezuela, because it's got little lift to it. Then.
Right.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I never made that connection. You're right.
Yeah.
It's the same progression.
Same progression.
Wow. So Norman was never unsure of himself, was he?
Norman's always been a very wonderfully cocky guy in the sense when it comes to his music thing. You know, he was just talented. He was very, aggressive. He had that thing about him. In most cases, his batting average was very high.
Right.
You know, him and Barrett. You know, they made a wonderful team. Mm-hmm. He was pretty much on the one. You know.
Was it kind of a mutual thing when you guys decided to move on?
Oh, it was no hard feeling, you know, because I talked with Barry, and that's when we had one of our biggest selling albums of all time, A Song for You. Mm-hmm. Because, like I told, I called Barry and said, Barry, we need to change because we're losing our identity, anytime. That one, yeah.
Great package, too,
if
anyone ever gets to see the original one.
Yeah, well, see, and also at that time we were going through changes, and he said, we ain't gonna put no pictures on the cover of the back. We're just gonna put that out there and let them guess to see, you know, who was in the temps. But that was that album was the catalyst. Came along at a very crucial time, you know, 1975.
Now this is with Jeffrey Bowen, who was actually at Invictus Hot Wax before.
Yeah, well, Jeffrey Bowen did "Temps in a Mellow Mood." Jeffrey Bowen, Frank. Frank, I can't think of Frank's last name.
Wilson?
Frank Wilson.
Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. So they produced Temps in a Mellow Mood.
Oh, I didn't realize that one. Uh-huh. So you were getting back with him. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And they.
And that's got that killer song with you has that killer jam shaky ground on it.
Song for You?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. We recorded that. Excuse me, brother. We rehearsed that out at Barry's beach house in Malibu.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And James Carmichael was the producer at first.
Uh-huh.
But, Jeffrey Bowen said, no, I can do better than that. Because Carmichael, you know, he's noted for all of the Commodores.
Commodores, right. Uh-huh.
But Barry said, all right, well, if you can do better than that, you go in the studio and let me hear what you can do.
Uh-huh.
And he came up with that track to Shake Your Ground. And I said, oh, and Happy People.
Right.
And he loved the way we did A Song for You.
Mm-hmm.
And so Barry gave him the producer's right for that album. And it was a huge selling album. But I tell you something, that album there is part of the reason why we left Motown.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Why is that?
Well, that album, they ran it in the charts, and the trades, rather. Abner was the president of Motown because Barry got tired of the day-to-day thing, so he would turn it over to different guys. Well, Abner at that time, Suzanne DePass was in charge of A&R. We took pictures saying gold, then they ran it a few weeks later. She's platinum.
Mm-hmm.
All right. For whatever reason, Abner was no longer the president, and they brought another guy in. I won't mention his name. And he said, no. It didn't go gold. It didn't go platinum. So we said, wait a minute. You're going to put it in the trades that it's gold and platinum? Now you're going to come along and tell, rather, they put it in there saying it's gold and platinum, mm-hmm. and then you're going to come along and say it didn't do platinum? So we were saying, well, who do you believe?
Right.
And we had a meeting with him, and this guy slammed his hand down on the table. And said, who's your attorney? And I said, well, our attorney is Abe Summers.
Mm-hmm.
Slammed his hand down on the table and pointed it at us. You get rid of him, and things will be better for y'all around here. Suzanne sat there and said, oh. And Susie Iketa was our project manager. We all looked. When we left the meeting, I said, we got to go.
Wow.
we got to leave here. And we still had time on the contract. And Barry was down in La Costa, I think, is the place where he would go and relax. And Suzanne called him and told him what was happening, that it was wrong what this guy did. And Barry called, and he said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I will have him to call you and apologize." He said, "Because I don't like my artists being treated that way." Because after we had that meeting with him, Marvin Gaye had a meeting with him also, and I got a call later on that day that the same guy, when Marvin left out of there, Marvin was almost in tears. He was so mad.
Wow.
You know, and that's when I said, so Barry called me again. He said, "What would it take to keep you guys here?" He said, you know we don't want to lose you guys. "What kind of money are you speaking of?" I said, "It's not about money, Barry." I said, "Anytime you got somebody running your company that is that way, it's not good for not only us, none of your acts."
Yeah.
And we left and went to Atlantic Records.
Right.
And because when that record, Song For You, really jumped off, we were so hot then that the guy that was running Motown said, "Well, I hate the temp so hot, they'll buy anything." And they released House Party. We were over in Amsterdam, Holland, when they sent me the list of what was on. I said, "House Party, that was an album with a lot of junk tunes."
Yeah.
Some good tunes. But
I always wondered about that. It's interesting you tell me that.
Yeah, well, that's how it came about. They just started
I feel better about my opinion of that record now.
No, I mean, I call it the way it is. It was. I wasn't happy with it when I, you know, they just grabbed tunes out of the can that we had recorded, you know, and I said, "Oh, this album's not going to do nothing, man." I said, "It's junk tune." True enough, when they released it, didn't do anything.
Right.
And then they came with Wings of Love album, which there again, I told Barry up at his place, said, "This album's not going to sell." And Jeffrey Bourne had, you know, produced that one. So he wanted to know why. I said, "No, I have the temp sound." He had all these girls and very sound, no temps harmony, and a very sparse kind of production. It was too, it was too far out there. True enough, when it came out, didn't do a damn thing. So he called Jeffrey Bourne. "Jeffrey, Otis is up here," and this is Barry. "Otis said his album's not going to do anything. He don't think it's going to do well at all." So Jeffrey tried to explain, "Well, you know, I wanted to take the temps and, you know, do a little." I said, "Yeah, I understand all that." I said, "But one thing you don't mess with. You don't mess with the sound of the group. If you want to add girls, but keep that identifiable sound." When they released it, didn't do nothing. You know, so we've had some very interesting times, you know, highs and lows.
Well, the late 70s was kind of an interesting time for a lot of people I know, and because there was a little bit of confusion about, you know, with the disco thing coming in, about where do you go, how do you incorporate that, what do you do? So a lot of people were in transition then.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
But I want to ask you about, jump forward a little bit, because it's very interesting. I want to ask you about getting together with Rick James, because obviously you'd come back to Motown at that point.
Yes.
But Rick James really kind of, you know, with Super Freak, brought you back in, and in a very kind of, I don't know, subtle way, in a way, said, "Hey, remember these guys. These guys are still here, and they still matter."
Well, when Rick did, I think you might be speaking of Standing on the Top.
Okay.
Because we did do some background on Super Freak, you know. We did.
Well, that's where he calls you out. That's why.
Right, Temptation Sing.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. But in 1982, 83, thereabout, 82, I think it was, we had the reunion tour. David Eddy, Dennis Melvin, myself, Glenn Leonard, and Richard Street.
Right.
And we wanted to make an impact, you know, with people had been asking, will the original Temps ever get back, minus Paul, because Paul, you know, had passed, you know, a few years prior to. So we finally got to the point of us, you know, getting back together. And so that was the tune that Rick James came up with and called Barry. He said, "Man, I got a track for the Temps." And then Barry called me. He said, "Man, Rick James got this tune for you guys." He said, "We got to cut it. This is great, you know, especially with you guys doing this reunion." And we went in the studio and recorded Standing on the Top. And, yeah, that, there again, that was another one that was funkier than Unwashed Armpit, you know. So when I heard the track, I said, "Ooh, I like that. Jump on." You know, we used to do it, but we stopped doing it because, you know, we have so many tunes to try. Right. And so it's kind of like way on the back burner.
I'm curious, you know, there's been a lot of so-called boy bands in the last few recent years. were obviously, in my mind anyway, taking a page from your playbook. And I wonder if any of these guys, have they ever given you the nod, given you the props for being there at the beginning?
No, I can't say it. I think we had a little slight mention from, I think it was NSYNC, they did something of ours. Mm-hmm. But most cases, no. I can't recall any one of the boy bands that would just really pay that kind of homage, you know, the Temps, mm-hmm. Boop Bop Bam, no. Ones that I ultimately respect over all of them is the Beatles, mm-hmm. because they did give it up. Mm-hmm. They said, yeah, Motown, Temps, that's what we get out. Yeah. In fact, I was looking at, in my home, I have a telegram that mm-hmm. was sent to me from John, Ringo, Paul, and George, mm-hmm. and I had it framed. And they sent it to the Apollo congratulating us because my girl had, made it to number one and sold over 1 million copies. And Spain, who was the stage manager at the Apollo, he said, Temps, you got a telegram from the Beatles. And I rushed down there and got it and tore it up because, you know, at the time, the Beatles were huge.
Right.
So to get any kind of acknowledgement from them mm-hmm. was the coup de grace, you know. So, mm-hmm. you know, but they're the ones that, you know, would say, you know, Motown, Temps, you know, Little Richard,
right.
Chuck Berry,
right.
James Brown. So they gave it up. And it seemed like when they mention all those black artists, it was like white Americans said, oh, really? That's who they are? Well, let us focus in on them also. And that just even opened the floodgates for them listening and accepting black music on a grander scale. Because, you know, a long time ago, you know, black music was just black music, R&B, or whatever. And you'd have to turn way down to your dial into the radio to try and hear it. And the system was so weak, you almost need a earphone to hear it, you know. But after a while, you know, it got greater acceptance, and so Beatles were the ones that I really.
Do you remember back then? I mean, do you remember the feeling? What it felt like back in? I guess it probably would have been 1964 or so, when you first started doing, you know, college shows and shows for white audiences and radio shows. Did that, and then you went to the Copa and things like that. I mean, was that just a kind of an amazing moment?
Oh, leave off kinda. That was an amazing moment, mm-hmm. you know, because at that time, Motown, the Beatles, you know, were breaking down all kind of music barriers that had long been, mm-hmm. you know, instituted about far as being black music being accepted far as white America listening to mm-hmm. it. So to do colleges, and we were doing colleges up to Yin Yang back then, mm-hmm. To do colleges, you know, with a great majority of them being white audience, it was wonderful because music is colorless.
Right.
You know, and it just proved that because I never will forget that we've played certain places in the South back during the 60s, and there was a rope in this year, auditorium, mm-hmm. right down the center of the auditorium. Blacks on one side, whites on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Came back to that same auditorium the next year on the Motown Review Tour. Whites and blacks sitting side by side, booty banging, high-fiving. Mm-hmm. And we were singing with tears in our eyes because it shows you what music can do.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes music can do what a lot of politicians can't do.
Right.
Bring people together. And we've seen that on quite a few occasions. In Mississippi, we played Ole Miss, and this is when Archie mm-hmm. Manning was the quarterback for Ole Miss before he went pro.
Right.
And Eddie and myself, we were standing there watching the crowd build up and the technicians set up the stage. And I guess black folks came in and they didn't have the tickets to sit down front. But I guess they said, well, shoot, we're going to sit down front because the Temps is here. Mm-hmm. But they didn't have the tickets for that because the white folks had the tickets to sit down front.
Right.
So when the people that had the tickets to sit down there, mm-hmm. Black folks didn't want to move. So it became an eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation almost.
Wow.
So Eddie and myself walked out and we asked the guys to cut on the PA system. And we made an announcement, please don't do this. We came here to perform for everybody.
Right.
So please sit where you're supposed to sit. We don't want no, you know, whatever we said at that time. And the amazing thing about it is they stopped.
Mm-hmm.
They listened at us. Black folks went and sat because their tickets was on the side. Good seats still, but I guess they wanted to be right down front. And, you know, white folks sat down. And Eddie and myself, we looked at each other and said, wow, They listen at us, and we're nothing but singers. Mm-hmm. But it shows you sometimes people, for what we do, of our ilk, can get across more so than certain politicians.
Now, you just reminded me, so I just want to go back to the Whitfield era just one more time, because I'm curious. With all those songs you were doing, Runaway Child, Running Wild, Cloud Nine, Ball of Confusion, Papa Was a Rolling Stone, all serious messages in these songs, you were sugarcoating it in the sense of creativity, but you were not hiding the messages in any way.
Right.
What kind of reactions did you get from that? I mean, were people always supportive of it, or how did people react?
We didn't get no negative response whenever we would do it.
Huh.
Well, you know, you got to be reminded it was Sign of the Times, and everybody mm-hmm. knew what was happening, and so I guess they found a certain kind of release mm-hmm. when we would perform, because not only were we performing those kind of songs, then, we'd break into Police Returns and, Since I Lost My Babies, so it was a balance that they said, okay.
Right.
And at the same time, we would sing what was happening in the world, and we never got any negative feeling at all.
Wow, that's fantastic.
No negative response.
Okay. Now, one thing people don't realize is, some people may not realize, because keep hearing your oldies all the time, is you guys have certainly had your share of hits in the past few years as well. You guys have stayed current all this time.
Yeah, well, it's a work ethic. Mm-hmm. We don't take anything for granted. We know that whenever we go in the studio, we always try and give our best and stay current and give even more than what they would expect from the Temps.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Like our last album for Motown, Legacy.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot begin to tell you how wonderful that CD is.
Mm-hmm.
It'll never see the light of day.
Hmm.
Great, great songs, great produced songs, well put together album. Loss.
And just because of politics or whatever in the company?
Yeah. See, and I will not sit here and denigrate, Motown now mm-hmm. because we've had some wonderful times, and Motown's and Temps will forever be connected throughout history. But the one thing that's constant in life is change.
Mm-hmm.
And the Motown today is not like, when Barry had
sure.
it, Barry didn't have to answer to anyone.
Right.
If he believed in artists, he could spend whatever, however much money he wanted to spend without mm-hmm. having to. Well, Barry, you're spending too much. My money. I believe in them. I'm going to do this. Motown today.
You think that was part of the secret of what made Motown great?
Oh, sure. Barry had latitude.
Mm-hmm.
He could do the way he wanted to do it, if he wanted to do it at all.
Mm-hmm.
Companies like that. And you're a computer readout now.
Right.
You got like when Kadar Massenburg was running Motown, he said, Otis, I have to go to a board meeting, I think every Tuesday or Wednesday, one of the days of the week. He said, not one time have any of those guys asked me about, man, do you know that's a great album, the Temps got out, Bip Bop Bam, or whatever artist mm-hmm. would be. They never ask about the money, about the music. They always ask him about how much money you spend. You can't spend no $1 million on the Temptations. He said, I didn't spend no $1 million on the Temps. He said, lucky for me, I had my CFO there, mm-hmm. and we would run it down. And he said, but I don't know how much longer I can take this here. He said, because if it's an artist you believe in, you have to spend the money,
right.
Especially if it's good and there, So, but like I said, the Legacy, great CD, never see the light of day, and it bothers us.
Well, let's talk about...
Okay.
Yeah,
you guys
got to
get out of here.
Yeah. Oh, you need to let me
get something. Definitely want to talk to GC.
Yeah.
I just got a couple more, and then we'll switch over to GC. Is that
okay?
Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
You're all right?
Oh, I'm fine.
Okay, good. I just wanted to talk about the new album.
Good time, we got to do that. That's why we're here.
Exactly. So let's talk about this new album, Reflections, which is it's a collection of you guys going back and recording songs that other people had hits on at Motown.
Right.
And I wanted to ask you what inspired it, and how did you choose the songs you wanted that you did?
Well, what inspired Reflections was the mere fact that we knew we were leaving Motown, And rather, see, it would have been the easy thing just to go and do regular contemporary songs, you know, unheard of, mm-hmm. you know. But these songs are already hits, mm-hmm. you know. So the only thing that's different is that we're adding the Temptations Midas touch, if mm-hmm. I can say without being egotistical. Ben Wright mm-hmm. And Steve, the Scotsman Harvey, the two producers that we work with, did a marvelous job on coming up with, you know, different kind of sense of feel on these songs. And so Shelley and myself sat down, Shelley Berger, who is our manager since 1966. We sat and talked, and we just felt it would be even probably a less of a... what can I say? Something that would kind of lessen the thing of making it even be more of a hit, because we're dealing with already hits that were right. already uh-huh. Hits. We would just be adding our own inflection mm-hmm. to them. So when Shelley met with the people over at Universal, they were very receptive mm-hmm. about the concept. And so it was like straight ahead, you know. Mm-hmm. And then when we went in and recorded it, and it turned out so well that the powers to be over at Universal, you know, bang, damn, they were very geeked up, and they are very supportive, you know, of this new CD, Reflection. So, and anytime, I'll use this one as a highlight, anytime, like, neither one of us wants mm-hmm. to be the last to say goodbye. Mm-hmm. Anytime you deal with a Gladys Knight and the Pips song, mm-hmm. like, hey, either you sing it just as good, if not better, or you better leave it alone.
Right.
Because they are the yardstick to measure by, especially Gladys. And I must say, we did a very commendable job, and I'm just putting it very mildly. But those mm-hmm. that have heard it, because we got a response from a young lady that works on Tyson's website, and she said she could not stop playing that song. And then the same song that hits me that way, not the same song, but Ain't Nothing Like the Real Thing.
Yeah.
Mm-mm-mm. So every song has got merits and legs on their own. So it's a great, great CD, if I must say so. And mm-hmm. I try and listen to whatever we do with objectivity. I don't get caught up, well, it's the temps, and you know, it's going to, yeah, you know, you can make the best music in the world if it is not supported and got out there for the people to know that we have mm-hmm. something. You know, it don't mean a sack of beans. But I'm crazy about Reflections.
Yeah, I always felt like Gladys Knight and the Pips were kind of one of the secret weapons of Motown, because even though, you know, their original version of Respect was a big hit, they did not necessarily have a lot of huge, huge hits at Motown. But you listen to all of their Motown records, and they bring the funk on every one.
They were some of the best that ever got behind the mic, and some of the best that ever performed on the stage. Gladys Knight and the Pips.
Yeah.
I mean, they made us sweat them many a day when we would have to be on the show with them. And uh-huh. then we made them sweat, too. So it was, oh, yeah. I mean, we must keep it equal.
Yeah. So I know back in the day, Motown had a practice of they would try a lot of different songs on a lot of people. Speaking of... I said Respect, didn't I? But I meant...
Yeah. you meant...
I'm thinking of Otis and Aretha, but
yeah.
Similar situation, but...
Thing about the grapevine.
I'm thinking about Heard It Through the Grapevine, of
right.
course. So that's the one example where they actually had the hit on two artists.
And Marvin was
Pips
bigger.
And then Marvin,
Marvin was
even bigger. So I know that there was a practice of trying songs on different groups to see sort of what fit. Had you guys ever tried any of these songs before that you're doing on Reflections?
No. No, this is our first time doing any of the songs on Reflections. So it's songs that I'd always enjoyed and imagined the Temps doing, mm-hmm. you know, a long time ago. So now here it is in reality. So, no, this is our first time doing any of these songs ever.
Nice. And it was fun to do, fun to put the record together?
Let's say this. It was a challenge.
Really?
Oh, yeah, because it came at a time when we had set up a time to do this CD, mm-hmm. but the paperwork going, getting released from Motown and getting all the paperwork done, it just was overlapping so that mm-hmm. it would bleed over into the time that we had to record. So whenever we had time to record, we would come in off the road and go in the studio and record. Come out of the studio the next day, right back on the road. Mm-hmm. So it was very challenging because we were body tired, mentally mm-hmm. tired, throat tired, but we knew what we had to do. And we were trying to get it done in time to qualify for the Grammys. Mm-hmm. But it just got to be, we said, hey, we'll just wait and be up for Grammys for next year.
Right.
But it was...
Don't you guys have enough Grammys by now? Come on.
Never enough. The Grammys are the equivalent to the Oscar, to the...
absolutely.
Anytime you can get some honors like that, mm-hmm. It's never enough of those because it don't have to happen. So when you do get a chance to have it, and when I come in off the road, I go into my trophy room. I say, oh, I do it. Yeah, they still laugh. Yeah.
How many of those do you have? How many Grammys
I have four.
Do you have? You have four.
Okay. And hoping that Reflection will bring five.
And you are in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, of course, as
been
well.
Been in that since 1988, 89, yes.
Wow, okay. So you were almost one of the originals.
Yeah, because normally you have to wait 25 years before you even come up. And, we were put in there real right. quick. Yeah.
Now, so you guys are out on the road plenty these days. You're about to go out again. Just sort of tell people what do they see today when they go to see the Temptations.
I think they see the best of both worlds, mm-hmm. from what we're noted for from the '60s all the way up to this point, and we do "Stay," which was our most recent hit, mm-hmm. which was out in 1998. "Treat Her Like a Lady." We try and get in what we can, in the amount of time span that we have to work with. So it's the best of both worlds. We know that we will forever have to do the "My Girls" and "I Wish It Would Rain" and "Ain't Too Proud to Beg" and "The Way You Do" and "Just My Imagination." Those are cornerstones. We sit and talk, and because, like I said, we're in a quandary about how many we can put in off mm-hmm. of this new CD, Reflections, which we got, what, GC, about three or four in. Mm-hmm. And so we know we got to put those in because we got to support the CD.
Right.
And then still do what the people, want to see the temps that we're known for. So it's up there again. It's a delicate balance that we have to try and, walk in. We'll walk it.
Can I make a request?
Sure.
"Since I Lost My Baby."
That's in the show.
Oh, it is. All
oh,
right.
See? Okay. Now, see?
I got to come out.
Oh, yeah. That's in there.
Love that song.
Yeah, Terry, he does favorites. A great job on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, see, but that's, that's what I told you about "Treat Her Like a Lady." Y'all, yeah, we still, oh, great, because the girl, she went off. Oh, yeah, that's mm-hmm. nice. But it's a great thing that people be having so many hits mm-hmm. that they want to hear from the Temps.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Okay, well, Otis, I want to thank you very much for coming to the Rhino Podcast.
All right, it's my pleasure. It's been a pleasure. And for all you fans that's listening, Reflections, do get it. I think you will enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now I'm back with the Rhino Cast. We are talking to G.C. Cameron of the current version of the Temptations, also a vintage member of the Spinners, and noted solo artist as well.
Wow.
And fill me in on anything else I'm forgetting about.
Oh, that's plenty. that's admirable. Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
GC, it's good to have you. GC, for some of our listeners who might not know your history very well, bring me back to the Spinners, how you guys got together really quickly and how you came to Motown. You were originally on Motown, is that right?
Yes, I came in from Vietnam in 1967 after 5 years in the Marines.
Wow.
And joined the Spinners. I came home September 67. In October, I was a Spinner. In November, we opened up at the Apollo for Marvin.
Wow.
So the transition was very different and unique within itself. It was truly a great blessing because to make a transition like that, I never thought about it until later and realized how important it was to just make it back home. And the music that I began to associate myself with was music that helped get us through the war. It was amazing.
Right.
I remember I was wounded, laying up in the hospital ship, the USS Okinawa, mm-hmm. and I heard this song called "I Was Made to Love Her,"
mm-hmm.
Stevie Wonder.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember raising up in the bed, you know, and listening to this song. And I think that the Four Tops had a song called Just Ask the Lonely.
Mm-hmm.
And those two songs are songs that hurled me through every day of being in that area and mm-hmm. doing what we had to do. And so it coming into the Spinners was unique, and it gave me the opportunity that I had wanted, I guess, all my life, and that was to be a singer of songs, mm-hmm. to express mm-hmm. my feeling outwardly, to verbally draw pictures, in a sense, as an artist. And getting with them was unique within itself, and I learned much from them. They were and are an extremely great group of guys, and I do have a lot of love, a lot of agape love for them.
Some people have seen that movie. I was just thinking of some people have seen that movie, Good Morning Vietnam. I don't think they realize that there's actually a lot of truth to that. That's a true story in a lot of ways.
Lots of truth.
Just
lots
in terms of the importance of the music,
the music
that was played over there.
The music was the lifeline. It was the intravenous feed for the soul, in a sense, you know, mm-hmm. to keep the contact between us and the world, the people who we love so that we believe we were there fighting to protect. That was mm-hmm. the connection.
Mm-hmm. Now, so you weren't a professional singer before you went into the service?
No.
Now, and when you came out, the Spinners were they already existing as a group?
The Spinners was existing as a group for several years.
Okay.
And Harvey Fuqua and Marvin Gaye auditioned me to be with the Spinners. So Marvin came by and listened to what we were doing. I think he asked me to sing one song, and I sang a little bit, and he said, he'll do. And that was the end of the audition, mm-hmm. you know, for the people coming in. So mm-hmm. Harvey and Marvin auditioned me for the group, in a sense, and that was the beginning of it. And from that moment on, it was that simple.
Do you recall that there was a particular direction that they wanted to take the Spinners in, or they had... Did Motown have a certain, you know, game plan or something?
Well,
like that,
no, not really a game plan. I think it was a situation where we were in a situation where we could not actually think for ourselves. Mm-hmm. But Motown consists of such a stable of incredible people.
Right.
Until it was a very difficult thing for anyone to weave themselves through that which was already established.
Right.
Now, the Spinners had an established sound and an established look, mm-hmm. but the producers, and I won't say that we had lesser producers because we had Stevie Wonder, and
right.
that's where Sashane came from,
right.
so that's
uh-huh.
top-of-the-line people. But we had cats like Ivy Hunter and mm-hmm. just different great producers, you know, who had produced stuff on Martha and the Vandellas and everyone else. And I heard Otis say that, like a lot of the albums, one guy would do mostly all the songs. Well, on a lot of the Motown albums, they would share that with different producers mm-hmm. and say, for instance, they had one great big or two great big hit songs, and they would let other producers put songs on those albums, mm-hmm. which kept everyone sustained, in a sense, and helped okay. everyone to grow. Mm-hmm. So it was always excitement at Hitsville. You can count on it. It was always about the tune. It was always
right.
about the music.
Okay.
Always about the music. And that was what I found to be so unique, was that the love for music was so genuine and mm-hmm. so pure that it could be nothing but success. That's what music is.
Now, one of the things I've always been curious about as a Motown fan is you guys were on the VIP label.
Yes.
Temps were always on Gordy.
Mm-hmm.
Other, you know, Supremes were on Motown, etc. Do you ever know if there was a specific reason why one group might have been on a certain label versus
yeah,
another?
Yeah, I'm sure it was me.
Everywhere so the name I go, of the label was
everywhere I go,
to
they
you,
change
huh?
labels. I mean, it's like we got New Door, we had VIP, Mo West. You
uh-huh.
remember?
I
was
oh, yeah.
on,
mm-hmm.
I was on the first Mo West label.
Okay.
So I don't know.
You
but,
had that touch, huh?
No, I think it's evolution of labels that have so much going on, mm-hmm. and each person that comes into a company wants to establish their own identity, so they get involved in opening new doors, which I think is very necessary and essential, mm-hmm. to come up with these labels like that, to have a mother label and to have offsprings from that label.
But there wasn't any particular reason, like VIP was supposed to indicate some kind of identity.
Well, no, it was not nothing that was revealed to us about it, except it was a new label and we were going to be on it with It's a Shame. And that was good enough for us. I mean, you know, we could have been on Chicken Label. I don't care. You know, one time it was Chicken Label. It would have been really cool.
That's some good records on that label.
Yeah, wow. That's right. It's some great records on VIP.
So let's talk about It's a Shame, because it's such a monster hit.
Yeah.
I'm really curious. Stevie Wonder has only written songs in his history for a very, very few mm-hmm. number of artists besides mm-hmm. himself. Mm-hmm. How did it come to be that he decided he was going to bring this record to you guys? Because he's never even, I think, released it on himself, you know?
No, he never did.
And it's such a great record.
Yeah.
How did that come to you guys? Do you remember that?
Stevie and I were best friends.
Oh, really?
That time. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we hung out together all the time. Mm-hmm. And so the song came from him writing, and we went to a lot of clubs in Detroit. Then Detroit was blooming. Mm-hmm. In the 60s and 70s, I mean, that's where it was. And mm-hmm. so we hit every club, you know, Aretha's late sister Carolyn, all of, we were hanging at clubs. So uh-huh. Stevie and I would hang to late hours.
Mm-hmm.
And so one night
Aretha's sisters, both of them, very unsung talents, by the way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so he said, look, I got this tune for you. You and the guys, you can rehearse it tomorrow. You can listen to it. And I said, well, let me hear it now. So he went out in the basement.
Uh-huh.
And he owned the clavinet.
Club?
No, in his house.
After
I dropped him off. You know, uh-huh. I brought him back and dropped him off on the way home. And he started playing it. And it was like, well, I didn't pay no attention to it because Motown was full of tunes. Everything
right.
I heard, you know, I mean, if you listen to all these great groups,
yeah.
you know, it like, especially coming from where I came from.
Yeah.
And being mixed in the pasture with these giants.
Right.
Was like the super challenge itself. Do I come up to par after the Marines, after Vietnam? I mean, these guys are, these mm-hmm. are superstar people here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I, you know, and I've got to make an adjustment here. This is a must do. Situation. And
right.
so I weigh my options here. You know, it's
yeah.
like war. I have to put it into the same perspective. How do I take this hill?
Yeah.
It was
okay.
the same thing. And so who was who and what was what and how do I help the spinners to be better? Because after
right.
all, that's what I was there for, to contribute and see what uh-huh. I could do mixed with what they were doing to help us to get better than what we were.
Yeah.
And that was the way I approached it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to approach it from that angle because that's the only way I could see it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have blinders on, but I knew the camaraderie was necessary, and I also knew the competition was extremely stiff.
Right.
How we were going to get past that after weighing in who the spinners were, why weren't they bigger than they were, being as talented as they were,
right.
what obstacle is that to get over, how do we get around it? So there were many things that went through my mind
right.
that were very prevalent and had to help me to get from point A to point B.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how It's a Shame came to be. So we went in the studio, Stevie cut it, bam, you know, and right away everybody's saying, whoa.
Yeah.
That's different, you know, mm-hmm. but that was one of the reasons Stevie cut it, because he knew I was a different kind of singer.
Yeah.
And it was something he's never heard before, someone who sings with multiple voices.
Right.
And was capable of doing them on the same level. So that was exciting to him because he was very excited when
yeah.
it came to music, you know, and so hearing something for the first time was like, oh, yeah, okay, I could do this. And we did it, and he did it, and they took it and put it away for a year before they released it.
You're kidding.
Yeah, It's
That's
a Shame
incredible.
Stayed in the can for a year after we recorded it before it was released as a single.
Now, why is that? I mean, and there's a few stories like this in Motown,
yeah, well,
by the way.
Well, you know, like I said, there was just too much attention on so many people. We didn't have mm-hmm. That window of opportunity for attention had not reached us at that point.
Mm-hmm.
It was all done in its own time for its purpose.
Right.
So all that which is good is
mm-hmm.
all good.
Mm-hmm.
And It's a Shame was very good. it was just a thrill and a great blessing to be able to be with these guys and record this music and to be a part of such a great establishment and corporation as Motown with the talent they had. I mean, it was endless.
Yeah,
you could not wave nor swim nor boat through the talent.
You did. That was such a huge hit, though, at Motown. As I recall, you guys kind of had a hard time staying on that level at Motown. And then when did the shift to Atlantic come about?
The shift to Atlantic came in 1973.
Okay.
I left the group in 72.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. You went solo.
Yes, I went solo.
And you did a record with, is it Brian Holland?
I did an album with Holland Dozier Holland.
Oh, okay.
You're What's Missing in My Life.
Mm-hmm.
And I did from the motion picture Coolie High, there was a song called It's So Hard to Say Goodbye to Yesterday,
right.
Which
mm-hmm.
Boys to Men covered after the motion picture.
Mm-hmm.
So that particular song was nominated for an Academy Award.
Wow.
And for some reason, it just kind of suddenly disappeared suddenly. But it was a great song. It still remains that way. For some reason, I've been blessed to cut songs that linger.
Yeah.
And stay around for a while, and that's very, very good, you know, to be able to cut that kind of music with great producers and writers. Mm-hmm. You know, Freddie Perren, Freddie Perren wrote It's So Hard to Say Goodbye to Yesterday, he and his wife Christine.
Mm-hmm.
So to be able to work with them and different people that I've been blessed to work with, you know, It's incredible.
Yeah. Where did you go from there? Have you been working solo all the years?
Sure, I went solo. I went solo in 72.
Mm-hmm.
And first album I did was called Love Songs and Other Tragedies.
Okay.
Then I did a G.C. Cameron album, which It's So Hard to Say Goodbye to Yesterday was on.
Right.
Then I did G.C. and Sarita. I did What's Missing in My Life with Holland Dozier Holland,
right.
Then G.C. and Sarita, Sarita and G.C. Cameron album.
Talk a little about Sarita, because she's such a beautiful voice on that woman.
She was the best. Yeah. She was simply the best. I mean, she's just an incredible human being, marvelous singer.
Yeah.
You know, and she was one of my favorite human beings on the planet.
Yeah.
And not just because she liked G.C. Cameron's music, but because of her talent and her ability. And she was always kept down to a point where I felt she should have really been up. Because she was
now,
a very bright light.
She was married to Stevie.
She was married
to
Stevie.
Do you think that had something to do with it?
I don't think so. Like I say, Motown was full of incredible talents.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there was never, it was all business. It was never personal.
Yeah.
From my point of view, that's life itself. You know, you can make it personal if you want to, but it's all about business, and the bottom line is success.
Right.
So she also wrote It's a Shame with Steve.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, she and Lee Garrett. Yeah, Lee Garrett, the three of them penned It's a Shame. And
did they write it knowing that they were going to do it for you guys?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, that's fantastic.
Absolutely.
So it was just a gift for you, huh?
Yeah, it was designed specifically for the Spinners. I mean, it was true. It was something unique within its own time, and we were blessed to be recipients of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were very happy about that record.
Okay, so you did, so you worked with Sarita, and then where did you go from there?
Then I did a lot of clubs in the South.
Okay.
And I did a number one record.
Like the kind of Malico circuit?
Yeah, I did an album with Malico.
Okay.
Called Give Me Your Love, which was one of the best albums I've ever recorded.
Yeah.
And it's huge in the East, Middle East, in that area, in the Japan. And
really?
Oh, huge. Like Sarita and GC, that's big over in the Japan and that area, the Asian market is really huge. And I did an album with a group called The Tams.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And that went to number one down in it was the beach music.
Yeah.
So we did, this was about 7 or 8 years ago.
Wow.
I did a number one record with them. So, you know, it's just kind
of... It's an amazing scene, too, that whole North Carolina scene.
Yeah, Myrtle Beach, man. Uh-huh. You know, I lived there. And
they're keeping it real down there.
They're keeping it real. They keep it soul.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's real music. And, you know, And the song that I cut with them was called Walking Dr. Bill, which was B.B. Mm-hmm. King's first song, his first recording.
Mm-hmm.
So it went to number one in the beach circuit thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I was working, doing music. Every opportunity that we got to do music is what we looked forward to.
Mm-hmm.
My band,
mm-hmm.
people that I was blessed to work with, a lot of talented young people.
Yeah.
Locals, you know, but talented just the same.
Now, did you guys know each other from back in the day at Motown?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how did it come about that you you came to join up with the Temps?
Well, I always wanted to be a Temp. I mean, you know, everybody
sure,
wants to be a Temp. You know, that's, yeah. Like I say, time evolves and creates opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
The opportunities it creates, we never know about until we are a part of the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a good idea employs many people.
Yeah.
And so that idea of a temptation has employed many people.
Right.
And so to be one of the people who have been blessed to come into the fold of the Temptations, you know, we had a couple of missed calls trying to get into the group where I missed Otis and Otis missed me, and
mm-hmm.
they were constantly working. But when we finally worked it out to a point, you know, I came into the Temptations with a great vision to be that what Otis needed me to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that is someone who could assist what he already had to try and contribute mm-hmm. to what the Temptations are about. I realize that it's an institution that deals with a infinite spectrum of people. Now there are a new generation out here that mm-hmm. needs to know who the Temptations are.
Right.
So my focus at that point was, how do I contribute to this organization to reach those young people who are going to be buying Temptations records in the next 4, 5, 6, 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so that meant reassessing everything that we've done, me as an artist, and trying to bring that to the table so that Otis could use it according to how the group is structured
mm-hmm.
and how it feels better for the people that we do music for, the audience, the fans, the friends, people who pay to come out and see and hear us. So my great challenge for this being in this group is to be all of that which I never was before as an artist,
hmm.
to rise to the next level, to
mm-hmm.
keep up with the tradition of the group,
mm-hmm.
because it definitely is loaded with a honeycomb succulent amount of tradition. And I mean, really, you know, and to be able to be...
We're all just getting our head around that concept, I think.
Well, you know, the music on the level that we live on mm-hmm. is the same as the Toulouse-Lautrec's and the Gauguins and
mm-hmm.
the Vincent, all of the Mona Lisas, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
They're just paintings,
mm-hmm.
verbal paintings. And for the people who come by to hear and see, that's what we try and do, is reestablish that and make sure that these songs never go away, because these songs create peace in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And if the songs go away, it may be a void for that peaceful thing. Like Otis was saying, when you can sit next to a person and not notice the color of them,
mm-hmm.
you've reached a barrier that is not normal in this society. You've gone beyond. You reach into the soul of a human being and you're massaging it so
mm-hmm.
that it has no idea other than love about itself. So that's what we do. We distribute
wow.
love, and we put it into perspective so that people would love each other. I think we cut down on the crime rate considerably every time we work. I believe that, because people who are at your concerts can't do wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were home, if you got 15,000, 20,000 people at home, somebody's going to do something wrong. Somebody's going to get hit, a cut, a shot. But if they're at a Temptations concert, they're there for love purposes. And so by doing that, we've cut down on the crime scene in America. And I like to look at it
like
that.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So all of the government agencies out there
tell the government about that. They need to come
be hiring you for some
Yeah, they need to hire Tim so that
gigs.
We can... Yeah, but...
Just like a regular thing.
Yeah, it's really a great honor and a tremendous privilege to be in this group and to
mm-hmm.
be a part of it and to work diligently to try and live up to the standards necessary and do the work so that it's acceptable and to get better each show.
What's your favorite song in the set to do?
Every one of them.
Now, come on, pick out one.
I don't.
Really?
It's what I can get out of a song that night that makes it my favorite.
Uh-huh.
If it's sort of like a woman, you know, if she don't feel like being touched, she has a way of letting you know it.
Right.
You love her just the same, but you get out the house.
Right.
You know, now there are other times she's going to be romantic, and boy, what a song.
Uh-huh.
You know,
uh-huh.
So those different nights that we sing different songs, those songs give a little of themselves to us so that, to let us know that they're the songs and we have to approach them with the respect and the love necessary to get the best out of that song.
Mm-hmm.
A good song sung wrong is a bad song. You know, but a good song sung right is forever a good song.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're here for, to try and do it a little better every time we do it. And to be with this company, Universal, and to have this kind of interest in what we're doing right now is one of the most exciting things that has happened to me in a long time. And I'm sure the rest of the guys, you know, like Terry Weeks is one of the most incredible young singers I've been blessed to work with. I mean, he has certain buttons that I love to push to get him started. I mean, his abilities are unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't even know his own abilities, you know, but to work with him and to have Otis in a situation where he knows the business.
Yeah.
I mean, the music thing and how it works makes it easy for us.
Uh-huh.
And then Joe Herndon, you know, Joe is so unique within himself. He's a people person.
Yeah.
And people love him, and that makes a difference in what you do when people just automatically have this come to you, you know. And Tyson, well, Tyson speaks for himself. He's been here been with Otis 23, 24 years. And for a falsetto singer, that is a whole lot, my friend, believe me. He's a super pro.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes everything for me easy because I'm coming in with a bunch of professional guys who embraced me to come in and to just do the best at what it is that I do. And I'm grateful to be here to do that. And I hope we can do it to the level where the next generation and the next generation will take heed to this music that has been done before us and before them that we're doing and enjoy it. That's what we're here for.
Okay. G.C. Cameron, Otis Williams, The Temptations, I want to thank you so much for being here at the Rhino Cast.
I'm honored.
Today.
Thank you.
And we'll look forward to seeing you soon and hearing reflections.
Hey, thank you very much.
All right. For Rhino.com, I'm Eric Gladstone.